Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Lauer Editorial Review. The Lauer is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Lauer is an educational service in public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Lauer and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Lauer and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Lauer and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Czech story when we come back. Well, Joe Smith started the day early, having set his alarm clock made in Japan for 6 a.m. While his coffee pot made in Japan is perking, he puts his blow dryer made in Taiwan to work and shaves with his electric razor made in Hong Kong. He puts on a dress shirt made in Taiwan, his designer jeans made in Singapore, and a pair of tennis shoes made in Korea. Then after cooking up some breakfast in his new electric skillet made in the Philippines, he sits down to figure out on his calculator made in Mexico just how much money he can spend today. So he sets his watch made in Switzerland to the radio made in Hong Kong. He goes out and gets in his car made in Germany. He goes looking for, just as he has been for several months, a good-paying American job. After the end of another discouraging and fruitless day, Joe decides to relax for a while, so he puts on a pair of sandals made in Brazil, pours himself a glass of wine made in France, and then turns on his TV made in Japan and wonders why it is that he cannot find a good-paying American job. Well, instead of a good-paying American job, why doesn't Joe look for a good-paying American private business dealing in property instead of income? Now, if you'd like to tap into that power of private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's informative and entertaining. It's educational. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call right now to order yours. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine when you get there and send us an email request for your free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? You know, monetary policy is set by our Congress. Congress gets its instructions from the Federal Reserve Bank Board. And the Federal Reserve gets its instructions from those Class A stockholders of the Federal Reserve, all of them foreigners, by the way. They live in Switzerland, Germany, England, France, Japan, Saudi Arabia. These are not the people of America. The Federal Reserve is not an American institution. It's a foreign and alien institution. But it hasn't been imposed upon us against our will and over our objections. It was foisted upon us by President Woodrow Wilson and our Congress back in 1913. I say foisted. There was a little skullduggery in the process back in 1913, but Americans haven't complained about it. Americans have welcomed paper money, fiat currency, and the Keynesian or the Keynes theory of economics for more than 80 years. We seem to love it in this country. Along with it comes the income tax. Now remember that the central bank is the fifth plank to the Communist Manifesto. And the income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto. The eighth plank is Social Security. The tenth plank is free education for all children in public schools. And the first plank calls for the abolition of all right to property. These planks to the Communist Manifesto are the exact opposite to our Bill of Rights and to the Ten Commandments. Now, if you're having trouble making ends meet, you aren't the only one, because everywhere in the world where communism has been tried, it has failed because it cannot provide for the needs of the people. It's a neat idea. Predicated upon from each according to his ability and to each according to his needs. Sounds good. Sounds like good philosophy. Sounds like good solid and sound public policy. But unfortunately, it just doesn't work when you put it into practice. And so here in America, we're beginning to find that we're receiving the same results that the Chinese received and that the Russians received and that the Cubans have had for the last 40 years. In every country where it's ever been tried, it has brought poverty, failure, hunger, want, and finally economic collapse. But communism isn't something that's new. It isn't something that just developed in the last 100, 200, or 300 years. It's been around for about 5,000 years. It goes back to the Babylonians and the Egyptians, the Assyrians. It's the same foreign and alien ideology that God detested and commanded the Israelites not to follow, not to practice, and not to get involved in. But what does God know about economic policy? I mean, he's old, you know. He's been around for a long time. And we're young, and we're modern, and we're chic, and we're up to date, and besides that, our accounts are insured by FDIC insurance. But many Americans in the last century, I'm talking about the 19th, in fact, you could go back to the 18th century as far as that's concerned, and you can find Americans like George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Pelatiah Webster, Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, Garfield, and others who denounced paper money, who denounced the concepts that come from fiat paper money. Now, we tried paper money from 1692 to 1792 in the colonies, and it failed in all 13 colonies. All 13 tried it. All 13 went bankrupt. In 1783, the continental currency collapsed. In 1787, our founding fathers put in these 17 words at Article 1, Section 10 that says, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. And they thought they had banished paper money from America forever, or until, you know, a couple of elections, and then we would change that. By 1794, we had a U.S. National Bank, which was vetoed, finally, after two sessions, 40 years, from 1794 to 1834, by Andrew Jackson. Jackson had something to say about this U.S. National Bank. And Andrew Jackson said the following words to the money changers who approached him in the drawing room of the White House. He said, gentlemen, I have had men watching you for a long time, and I'm convinced that you have used the funds of the bank to speculate in the breadstuffs of our country. When you won, you divided the profits amongst you, and when you lost, you charged it to the bank. You tell me that if I take the deposits from the bank and annul its charter, I shall ruin 10,000 families, and that may be true. Gentlemen, but that is your sin. Should I let you go on, you will ruin 50,000 families, and that would be my sin. You are a den of vipers and thieves, and I have determined to rout you out, and by the eternal God, I will rout you out. And he did. He vetoed the U.S. National Bank in 1834, 5, 6, long in there. And we didn't have paper money until 1862 or 3, when President Lincoln brought in the famous greenbacks to finance the Civil War. From the Civil War on, finances in America have been all downhill. The bankers took control of our monetary policy during the Civil War, and they took control of Congress at the same time. So today, I think it was in the last election, 2004, 96% or more of the incumbents won re-election. These incumbents buy these elections from the campaign contributions that are made by the people who have bought their services. Congress is bought and paid for, and so is the president. So the old days when America was ruled by an electorate have been long, it's been long, long gone, it's long past. Probably back in the 1870s. Now, checks, the subject matter of our program, are a part and parcel of this economic policy. We went from paper money to gold and silver. We went from gold and silver to a U.S. national bank. We had thousands of banks in America printing their own paper. They were chartered by the individual states. As time progressed, we developed a Federal Reserve System, which then finally abolished gold in 1933, abolished silver in 1965. And from 1965 on, we have been on a strictly fiat currency. And indeed, the entire world is following the same road to ruin. The ultimate end of this is the ruination of everybody that participates in it. That's why I suggest that you move out of paper and into substance, move out of income and into increase, out of profit and into property, which is sanctioned by and authorized by God and the Ten Commandments. Now, a guy by the name of Mayor Rothschild, back in the 1700s, he said, you permit me to issue and control the money of a nation, and I care not who makes its laws. And today it doesn't make any difference which political power is there, party is in power, or who's making the laws. In the final analysis, the people who control the issuance of money control the political power in the nation. And the guy that controls the political power controls all the people of the nation. America is a controlled nation. Now, you have certain freedoms and liberties, but those freedoms and liberties are controlled. You know, you get in your automobile and you say, well, I'm free. I can drive from here to Los Angeles. Well, but it's very strictly regulated, your travel from here to Los Angeles. And you say, well, I'm going to go to Europe. Well, that's fine, but then your travel to Europe is very strictly regulated, and your reentry into the United States is strictly regulated, and what you can bring back with you is strictly regulated. And when you take a look at the regulations in your everyday way of life, and you compare that to Americans and their way of life in 1900, America is a very regulated society. Now, Benjamin Franklin made an observation. He said the colonies would have gladly borne the little tax on tea and the other matters had it not been that England took away from the colonies their money, which created unemployment and dissatisfaction. And Thomas Jefferson made an observation. He says if the American people ever allow private banks to control the issuance of their currency, first by inflation and then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all property until their children will wake up homeless on the continent that their fathers conquered. That has already occurred. And the outsourcing of employment from the United States to India or China or Japan or Korea is a part and parcel with this program of the banks controlling our currency and the corporations, the multinational corporations that have grown up around them, now control America. Americans don't control America. The corporations and the banks control America. You're just along for the ride. And whoever controls the volume of money in any country is absolute master of all industry and commerce, so said President James A. Garfield. Abraham Lincoln had a little something to say about money also. Abraham Lincoln, who during the Civil War had Congress issue $346 million in United States notes, which were spent in circulation as a debt-free and interest-free medium of exchange, said, "The people can and will be furnished with a currency as safe as their own government. Money will cease to be the master and will become the servant of humanity. Democracy will rise superior to the money power, and the money power preys upon the nation in times of peace and conspires against it in times of adversity. It is more despotic than monarchy, more insolent than autocracy, more selfish than bureaucracy. It denounces as public enemies all who question its methods or throw light upon its crimes." So President Lincoln understood the money power and the banks. And if that mischievous financial policy, which had its origin in North American Republic during the late war in that country, should become indurated down to a fixture, then that government will furnish its own money without cost, and it will pay off its debts and be without a debt. It will have all of the money necessary to carry on its commerce. It will become prosperous beyond precedent in the history of the civilized governments of the world. The brains and wealth of all of the nations of the world will go to North America. That government must be destroyed, or it will destroy every monarchy on the face of the earth. That was published in the London Times. Source: The Money Creators by Gertrude Coogan, 1935, republished in 1982 by Omni Books. Now, the American Bankers Association sent the following letter to all of their members on March 11, 1893, and it said, "Dear Sir, the interest of the national banks require immediate financial legislation by Congress. Silver certificates and treasury notes must be retired, and national bank notes upon a gold basis made the only money. This will require the authorization of $500 million to $1 billion of new bonds as the basis of circulation. You will retire one-third of your circulation and call one-half of your notes in. Advocate an extra session of Congress to repeal the purchasing clause of the Sherman Law and act with other banks of your city in securing a large petition to the Congress for its unconditional repeal for accompanying form. The future life of national banks as fixed and safe investments depends upon immediate action, as there is an increasing sentiment in favor of government legal tender notes and silver coinage." Source: Lincoln Money Martyred by Dr. R. E. Search, published by Omni Books, page 75. A conspiracy by the banks and banking interests from England, France, and Germany to control the monetary policy of the United States has been in effect right from the creation of the Republic in 1787. There has always been a conspiracy to take over and control it, because it's very lucrative and it's very profitable. The war in Iraq, as an illustration, shows you how profitable this war is. They actually lost $9 billion over there. That's an accounting problem. They don't know what happened to it. Money is flowing so freely at the rate of $6 billion a month into the Iraq war. It is making multimillionaires and billionaires out of literally hundreds of participants in that war. So don't feel bad about the few hundred American servicemen who are being killed over there. It's just good for business. William Jennings Bryan said there can be no reform without monetary reform, and he said that in 1896. And then Charles A. Lindbergh Sr., that is the father of Charles Lindbergh, the famous pilot, who was a senator, remember, in the Congress of the United States, he said it is manipulation of credit that creates the big deposits. A person borrows $100,000, we'll say. The bank takes his note drawing interest, but gives the borrower no money, simply gives him credit on the bank's books and then hands the borrower a checkbook. That note increases the deposits of the bank by $100,000. The bank has no additional actual money by that deal. The borrower then pays his bills with checks. Persons who get checks, with rare exceptions, deposit them in the same bank or some other bank that belongs to the FDIC. It simply amounts to a transfer of bank credits from the person giving the checks to the persons receiving the checks. And the above example explains in a general way why it is that the banks have 7, 8, or 10 times as many deposits as there is money in circulation. It's a common saying that we do business on bank credit. It is nearer to truth to say that the bankers do business on the borrower's credit. Charles A. Lindbergh Sr., The Economic Pinch by C. A. Lindbergh, published first in 1923 and then republished in 1976. Now, the modern banking system manufactures money out of nothing. The process is perhaps the most astounding piece of sleight of hand that's ever been invented. So said Major L. B. Angus, States in Slump, Ahead in Bonds. Source: America's Promise, Phoenix, Arizona. The Federal Reserve is not a government agency and is, in fact, an oppressive and extortionate privately owned money monopoly. That was put out by the state of Alabama, House Joint Resolution Number 90, memorializing Congress to repeal the Federal Reserve Act, passed and signed by Governor Fob James on March 2, 1982. Well, those are just some of the famous quotations on money made by some of the famous people, and especially a number of presidents of the United States, here in the United States. The money power and the money monopoly isn't something new. It's been around for thousands of years. The money monopoly controls England. The money monopoly controls Germany. In fact, the money monopoly controls Canada, Australia, Japan, China. It controls every country in the world. Now, there is a logical and systematic methodology from withdrawing from the money monopoly, and it's called the Ten Commandments and Thou Shalt Not Steal. It's a wild one. Most people don't want to participate in it, and they avoid it like AIDS, herpes, and VD. Then they complain about the communism. They complain about the tyranny. They complain about their governments, but they don't want to practice the Ten Commandments. Sounds like a guy banging his head against the wall. He doesn't like the pain, but he doesn't want to stop. And he doesn't know what he's going to do. If he continues on, he's going to kill himself banging his head on the wall. But I guess for some reason he doesn't want to stop. It doesn't make any sense. Monetary policy doesn't make any sense here in the United States or Canada or around the world. But the people of the world are addicted to paper money. They're addicted to the income tax. In fact, to show you, a fellow by the name of Steve Forbes ran for president in 1992 and 1996. And he said, what we need is monetary reform and particularly tax reform. And so he said, we need to eliminate this heavy progressive income tax, which is the feature attendant to the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, a heavy progressive income tax. The opposite to that is the tithing system, which takes 10% across the board from everybody. Well, Steve Forbes was running for president on the Republican ticket, and he lost, of course, to the president at that time in 1992, was George Bush Sr., who was defeated by Bill Clinton. Well, in 1996, Forbes ran again for president on the same platform for the Republican nomination. And the Republicans said, no, we want Bob Dole. And Bob Dole was in favor of keeping the income tax, as was George Bush Sr. And no, they were both opposed to the flat tax. Now, the people of America had an opportunity to vote twice to repeal the income tax, the second plank to the Communist Manifesto. And twice, in 1992 and in 1996, the people of America soundly rejected any repeal of the second and fifth planks to the Communist Manifesto. So this leads me to the conclusion that the people of America want fiat paper money through a central bank and an income tax, just the way it is. I don't want either, so I have withdrawn. And I suggest that you consider withdrawing from the system also and go back to the Ten Commandments and the Bill of Rights provided for in our Constitution and made possible by the fact that here in Australia, the United States, and Canada, all three governments mint their own gold coin, and it's in circulation today in 2006. So the excuse that, well, I have to use these banks and bank accounts and checks because everybody else does, is just plain poppycock. You can change anytime you want. You can change anytime you decide to. Now, so far, Americans have said, no, we're not going to. Well, okay. Well, then don't complain about the banks and banking, and don't complain about the control that government imposes upon you. Because in Wickard versus Filburn, the Supreme Court explained that very succinctly when they said, it is hardly lack of due process or equal protection of the law for government to regulate that which it subsidizes. And the banking monopoly is subsidized by Congress, and those that participate in the banking monopoly receive those subsidies, those benefits like Social Security and workman's compensation, unemployment insurance, old age and survivor's benefits. This income tax and Social Security are inextricably wound and bound together. You can't have one without the other. And I pointed that out to you the other day when I showed you that the Social Security number is your Siemens papers, which enables you to participate in the 108 benefits provided by Social Security and funded and paid for by the income tax. 108 benefits. Now, your Social Security number is your taxpayer's identification number. There's two ways to identify you as a taxpayer. Corporations and other non-individuals are identified by a TIN, taxpayer identification number, and individuals are identified by their Social Security number. Now, there's no law that requires that you have a taxpayer identification number or a Social Security number unless you're dealing in income. If you would stop dealing in income, deal in property, gold and silver coin, you wouldn't have any income for which you would owe an income tax. I know it's a wild new concept, but it's one I think that's worth looking into. And again, God told us not to engage in contracts with these foreign and alien gods. There's four statutes in Scripture that prohibit you from engaging in Social Security, taxpayer identification numbers, marriage licenses and birth certificates and all of these various and sundry government programs and benefits that everybody wants to participate in because you want the free lunch. But it's kind of like Social Security and public school. Social Security, as an illustration, there's three groups of people that pay into Social Security. The wealthy people who pay in $5 to Social Security and draw out $1. the middle class people who pay in $2.73 and draw out $1, and then the poor or the low income people who pay in $1 and draw out 68 cents. It's not a very good program. In fact, there is no retirement program anywhere in America that I know of that you can pay in so much in premiums and receive so little in benefits as is Social Security, which strangely enough, the American people hold as the third rail of politics. I wouldn't participate in it if there was any way to get out of it, and there is a way to get out of it, and so I stopped participating in it. And I'm happier because I did, but then here I am, 68 years old, and I don't draw Social Security. I don't have that safety net. I don't have that check coming in every month. And boy, am I happy that I didn't pay my $150,000 into Social Security so that I could draw back $100 and pay $50,000 to have somebody write me 120 checks. I didn't need that. And it gets worse as Social Security progresses on. And then it's even worse than that because Social Security is going bankrupt, and so is Medicare. And everybody knows that. It's unsustainable. The president's told you that. You've read that over and over again. It's unsustainable. And yet you continue to participate in the program. So when it does finally collapse and you lose everything that you paid in, you will become, as we say in law, the proximate cause of your own injury. So don't blame government, and don't blame the bankers, don't blame anybody but yourself, because you knew or should have known that those programs were insolvent, and you continued on with them anyway. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here, and we'll be back with more on the Chuck story right after this. I need to remind you that you are listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. Now, if you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week and has a radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, talking about the check and the check story. Gold comes into circulation by labor. Somebody has to physically go pull that gold out of the ground, and it takes as much labor today as it always has, going back to the Garden of Eden. So gold has a value measured in the sweat on your face, the sweat of your brow. Fiat currency comes into circulation by debt. It is loaned into circulation by those that create it. So when the Federal Reserve decides that they want to expand the money supply to stimulate the economy, they print up the money or authorize the credits, and then they lend it to the member banks. And we have a local bank here called the Century Bank of Gainesville, Missouri. And we go into the bank, and then we borrow the money. Let's suppose I want to borrow some money. So I go to the bank, and I pledge my farm as security, and I borrow $100,000. The $100,000 was created by the stroke of a pen by our banker, John Harlan, who issues a $100,000 loan, takes my farm as security. I agree to this by signing a contract, and then I start making payments to John. I have to pay him back $110,000 at the end of the year at 10% interest. This is very lucrative business for the bank because they got the money for nothing. Whereas if we were dealing in gold coins, somebody would first have to go out and put out $100,000 worth of labor in order to get $100,000 worth of gold out of the ground. He would then have to go to the bank and deposit it in the bank, and then John could only lend out that gold that he had on deposit, the physical gold. That's the way we used to do business, and it eliminated inflation. You couldn't inflate the currency because there was no more gold to lend out. Somebody woke up one day and said, well, what we need to do is to create paper money so that one paper dollar is equal to $1 worth of gold. as time progressed along. They took the gold into the banks, took the gold away from us and put it in a vault. Now they've left us with a fiat currency that they totally control. And in so doing, they totally control our economy. They control the outsourcing of jobs. They control your employment. They control your wages. They control your profits. There isn't any aspect of the American economy that the banking system doesn't control, and that includes the price of gold itself. And that's because they have the power of the printing press. Now, as inflation continues on, there's an ultimate finite end. This system, called the Keynes monetary system, goes on and it goes on and it goes on and it goes on for many years, and we Americans now hold the world record for fiat currency from 1913 to 2006. And it's now the world's reserve currency. All the nations of the world have tied their economies to this reserve currency, which has no backing, and pretty shortly it's going to collapse, just like they always do. But we've been at this now for 90 years plus. 90 years. That's phenomenal. And then it's nice to know that we hold the record before the final economic collapse occurs. Now, when these collapses occur, as we saw and as we observed down in Argentina here in about 2001, about 5 years ago, the Argentine economy collapsed. They simply got to a point where they could no longer pay their bills. There's coming a point in time, the president was just mentioning this the other day, he said that our balance of payments deficit is unsustainable. And we need to borrow $3 billion a day, every day, 365 days a year, from the Germans and the French and the Japanese and the Chinese, in order for us to pay our bills. Boys and girls, just picture this. What if you needed to borrow $300 a day, every day, just to pay your bills? At some point in time, it would consume the equity of your house, the equity of your stocks and bonds, the equity of your automobiles and chattels, until at some point in time, you wouldn't have any equity left with which to pledge as collateral for the loans that you're borrowing to maintain your standard of living. And at that point in time, there will be a radical adjustment in your living standards. That's what happened in Argentina. It's what happened in the United States in 1783 and in 1929. And it's what's going to happen in the United States and indeed worldwide very shortly. I'm not a prophet, so I can't tell you when it's going to occur, just that it has always occurred in the past. And unless these miracle workers have something up their sleeve to keep this thing going on in perpetuity, in spite of the economic laws to the contrary, well, I suspect it's going to happen again. So that's why I suggest to students that they be prepared now, out of debt, and you need a 4-year supply of food, shelter, and clothing to carry you through this period of time, such as 1930 to 1935. Or 1783 to 1787. These economic collapses occur from time to time, and when they do, there's a radical reorganization of wealth. Wealth gets transferred to the wealthier class. So the poor people get wiped out, middle class people typically get some of it wiped out, the high-end people get a little of it wiped out, and then there's some people up at the top, you know, the real sharks that make all the profit. Now, there was a time in America when we used to deal in gold and silver coin. Let me describe how that worked and how that system works even today. When I was a kid, there was a creek, and the creek's still there. It's called Wages Creek. I don't know that anybody is up there getting any gold out of it, but it's in northern Mendocino County, just north of Fort Bragg, California. And back around the turn of the century, when my granddad was a little boy, he told me about how people who held mining claims up and down the creek would go up to Wages Creek, and they would pan for gold. And you could make about a dollar a day, which was about wages. That's why they named it Wages Creek, because you could work at the sawmill or work in the woods, and you'd make about a dollar a day. Or you could go up and you could work panning for gold and you'd make about a dollar a day. Well, when a miner was panning for gold and he got his gold out of there at the end of the day at about a dollar, at the end of a month he might have as much as $20 or $25 worth of gold. Well, he'd take that gold down to Fort Bragg into the general store and they'd weigh it out. Now, those are called fines, and those fines are about 75% gold. So, you know, if the guy had around $25 worth of gold fines, the guy at the store would pay him around $20 or thereabouts, which was about 1 ounce of gold, which was about $120 double eagle. Now, the guy at the store, the merchant, he's making a little commission off of this for doing the service, and he would take a bunch of gold down to San Francisco from time to time and take it into the mint. Now, the San Francisco mint would take that gold and they would fire it up, refine it out until it was about 3/9 or 4/9 fine gold, and then they would mint it into a $20 double eagle, and they charged you a 1% cinnage charge to do that. And that's the way money came into circulation. It came into circulation by the work, by the labor of people who made it. It's what we call a commodity economy, a commodity money, a money that's worth as much as the things that you're trading it for. Now, a man might take that $20 ounce coin and trade it for a horse or a cow. And the guy that traded it for the horse or the cow might in turn trade it for something. And it was a part of the economy. And you can't inflate it. And you've either got it or you don't. And so the man might deposit it in the bank, and then somebody might borrow it, and then they might use it in their business, and then they would return it to the bank and pay some interest on it. Now, let's suppose for the sake of our discussion here that too many people mined too much gold, and there was so much gold floating around in the economy over here that people just didn't know what to do with all that gold. That would be inflation. But you see, the gold has a value of and by itself as a commodity for jewelry or for some other purpose. So it never worked to inflate the economy because somebody would divert it out and they would use it for jewelry or they would use it for some other purpose. And conversely, if you were working in the mill and you worked hard and you produced a lot of boards, you'd get paid a dollar a day. But if too many boards were produced and sales became sluggish, you'd have to lower the price of lumber by producing less of it. And then you'd have to lay off some people. And then you'd have to reduce wages. So if wages dropped to 90 cents, the man might go up to Wages Creek and work mining gold until he could make a dollar a day. Conversely, if the number of boards became in short supply, the lumber company might want to produce more boards, in which case they would hire more people, raise wages back to a dollar or a dollar and 10 cents, in which case you could make more money working in the mill, so you would abandon producing gold and go work in the mill producing boards. And this is called a market economy of supply and demand. Wages go up and down, the amount of lumber goes up and down, the amount of gold goes up and down based upon the demand for it, how many people want it. And so the economy remains pretty stable. It doesn't inflate and it doesn't deflate from 1865, for instance, to 1900. There was a 2% overall deflation. That is, if you put $100 in the bank in 1865, that $100 would still be there with the same purchasing power plus 2%. You'd have $102 worth of purchasing power out of that $100 or those $520 gold pieces. Now, since we've adopted fiat paper currency, if you took that same $20 gold piece in 1930, which was devalued to $35 in 1933, which has been further devalued and today sits at about $630, the purchasing power of a $20 paper dollar, that's a $20 note, Federal Reserve note, has gone from 100 cents in 1930 to about 90 or about 3 cents today. It's lost about 97 cents worth of its purchasing power. And we call that inflation. People like to talk about how much money they've made in the stock market, you know. They talk about their stocks and they talk about their investments. They talk about bonds and things like that. And from 1960 to 2000, the inflation rate was 5%, and the average increase in the stock market was 5%. So there wasn't any profit to be made in that 40-year period from 1960 to 2000. People talk about it. And they actually made profit in absolute dollars, but their purchasing power remained the same. They stood still. They didn't make anything. Now, at the same time, if you had invested in gold, you would have made a pretty tidy increase. Tidy increase because, not because the gold increased in value or that there's any more or less of it, because there's a certain amount of it in the Earth's crust and no more, but because it's been valued in paper, and then the paper has depreciated. And so the gold has appreciated, not because it has any intrinsic value or there's more or less of it today, but because the paper that it's valued in has been constantly decreasing. That's why I would suggest that you take your paper money and convert it to gold and get rid of that liability. Now, that's the way gold comes into circulation. Silver comes into circulation in the same way, except that silver is generally a byproduct of other mining operations, such as copper or gold mining or something else. The correct price for gold is 16 ounces of silver equals 1 ounce of gold, and 1 ounce of gold equals 16 ounces of silver. That's the way God designed it. That's how many ounces there are in the Earth's crust. And then when you use that sound money system, then you don't suffer losses. You don't make any gains, but you don't suffer any losses. Now, the monetary system creates a guardian-ward relationship, and the guardian-ward relationship between you, your government, and the banking system. And the way that works in the guardian-ward relationship is described in American jurisprudence, which is, that is a encyclopedia. It's a legal encyclopedia. It's what we go to get the description of the definitions of legal terms. So when we go to guardian and ward in American jurisprudence, it tells us that a guardianship is a trust relation of the most sacred character in which one person who is called a guardian acts for another called a ward, whom the law regards as incapable of managing his own affairs. So when you're declared to be a ward, you're being told that you're incapable of managing your own affairs. And here in America, most Americans are incapable, they are unable to manage their own affairs. For instance, Americans are unable to plan for their own old age. And so they need Social Security, and they need government to manage that Social Security program for them. Americans are unable to manage or take care of themselves during periods of unemployment, so therefore they have to have unemployment insurance to tide them over. Americans are unable to manage their money, and so they have to have a bank account where they can deposit their money, their buying papers, their purchasing papers, and the bank takes care of and manages their money for them. If you take a look at all of the services that are provided for you, insurance, and unemployment insurance, and workman's compensation, old age and survivor's benefits, birth certificates, marriage licenses, and driver's licenses, and auto registrations, and this goes on and on and on. All of these events, all of these services that are provided under the legal theory of the guardian-ward relation. Now, a curator is a guardian who is appointed by a court to control property of a minor. He's not a guardian of the person, but a guardian, rather, of the minor's property. And in some jurisdictions, a conservator may be appointed. Now, a conservator has the same power and the same obligations as a guardian so far as they relate to the property of the ward, so that, in effect, he is a guardian of the minor or a guardian of the estate. Now, the purpose of statutes relating to the guardianship or the guardian-ward relation is to safeguard the rights and interests of minors and of incompetent persons, and the courts should be vigilant to see that the rights of such persons are properly protected. The court having jurisdiction of a guardianship matter is said to be the superior guardian, while the guardian himself is deemed to be an officer of the court. So when you go down and open up a checking account at the bank, you're declaring yourself to be fiscally irresponsible, unable to manage your own money. And so you sign this contract, and it demonstrates my point. I mentioned this the other day. Now, you've been told all of your life that you ought not to sign contracts and sign agreements that you haven't read and that you don't understand. Now, here's a sample of an adhesion contract governed by Title 31 and Title 12 of the Banking Act at the federal level, and then numerous state statutes at your state level. And you haven't read those statutes, and those statutes are the public contract. It's the public policy of your state and of your nation. It's a guardian-ward relationship for people who cannot manage their money. So you have to hire somebody to manage it for you, and it has to be regulated by somebody, government. So the bank manages your money in a guardian-ward relationship, and the superior guardian, the state, regulates and manages the bank and your money and you. Now, in the last analysis, the appointment of a conservator in Section 22 tells us that in several states, statutes authorize a person who, although of sound mind, when he believes that he is incapable of managing his own estate or of caring for his own property, he may apply for, or he may request, or simply consent to the appointment of a conservator or a guardian of his estate, or of his person, or both his person and his estate, if he so desires, who, when appointed, the guardian possesses over the estate substantially the same powers and is subject in regard thereto to substantially the same duties as a guardian of an incompetent. So you don't have to be incompetent to declare yourself to be a ward of some other guardian in a guardian-ward relationship. You do this when you get a driver's license, and you declare yourself to be incompetent and unable to manage your own driving affairs, for which you need the state to regulate and control you. You do this in marriage. I'm unable to manage my marriage, and so I need a guardian. I need the state to enact laws, rules, and regulations, and hire a social lady to come out and to direct me, to tell me how to discipline my child, how to educate my child, how to protect my child from disease. And they enact laws and rules and regulations, and then they cause or force me to obey those rules and regulations that I could not or would not obey or practice of and by myself. And so we have to have a guardian to look after that. And so they're constantly probing and looking. They're watching you drive, and they're watching you marry, and they're watching you discipline your children. They're watching you educate your children. They're watching your business. They're watching your banking. They're watching your business practices, and they're watching your money practices. Government is watching you, boys and girls, in any and every way they can to guide you and direct you, because you've declared yourselves to be incompetent in these many, many areas of your lives. An interesting case comes up along that line. It's called Almeida Sanchez versus U.S. In seeking a rationale for the validity of a search, in this case, the government thus understandably sidesteps the automobile search cases, and instead the government relies heavily on cases dealing with administrative inspections. But these cases fail to support the constitutionality of the search. This man, Almeida Sanchez, is a Mexican driving his pickup loaded with marijuana with a green card. He's a legal entrant or a legal resident of the United States, but he's not a citizen. He's 30 miles from the Mexican border in California hauling a load of marijuana. At 2 o'clock in the morning, two Border Patrol agents see him driving through an intersection that's well lit, and they saw that he was a Mexican, and they said, "No, there's something wrong here, a Mexican in California." And they went out and stopped him, and they searched, and they found the marijuana. They arrested him and prosecuted him, and the conviction was overturned by the Supreme Court because it was an illegal search. It was an illegal search because this man was not a ward of the state. People who are wards of the state can't deal in drugs. It's against the law. In Camara versus Municipal Court, the court held that administrative inspections to enforce community health and welfare regulations could be made on less than probable cause to believe that particular dwellings were the sites of particular violations. Yet the court insisted that the inspector obtain either consent or a warrant supported by particular physical and demographic characteristics of the areas to be searched. The search in the present case was conducted in the unfettered discretion of the members of the Border Patrol who did not have a warrant. They did not have probable cause, and they did not have consent. And the search thus embodied precisely the evil that the court saw in camera when it insisted that the discretion of the official in the field be circumscribed by obtaining a warrant prior to the inspection. Two other administrative inspection cases relied upon by the government are equally an opposite. They're Colonnade Catering Corporation versus United States and United States versus Biswell, which both approved warrantless inspections of commercial enterprises engaged in doing business, which are closely regulated and licensed by the government. In Colonnade, the court stressed the long history of federal regulation and taxation of the manufacture and sale of liquor, and in Biswell, the court noted the pervasive system of regulation and of reporting imposed upon licensed gun dealers. But a central difference between those cases and this case is that businessmen who are engaged in such federally licensed and regulated enterprises accept the burdens as well as the benefits of their trade, whereas the petitioner here in this case was not engaged in any regulated or licensed business. The businessman in a regulated industry, in effect, consents to the restrictions that are placed upon him. Now, boys and girls, if you want to consent by license and permit, don't complain about the government when it regulates and controls you. That's the bottom line. People with social security numbers ought not to complain about the IRS auditing their records and books. It's a guardian and ward relationship. Licenses, permits, social security, our government guardian ward relationships. Hey, we're about out of time. I got to wrap it up, and we'll see you back here tomorrow night talking about this thing of the check in the check story next time. Now, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.